The Right Question is funded by the Steele Reese Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Why is the book titled Last Stand?
Well, that's a question that we bandied about as this was being put together. We actually had a couple of other titles. One of them was Save the Humans, based on a bumper sticker that Ted had put on a lot of his vehicles. Another one was a title, Citizen Ted, that was passed along to me by my writer friend David Quammen. And ultimately, we settled on Last Stand, knowing that it carried no small amount of irony. When we Westerners think of Last Stand, we of course think of George Armstrong Custer. And the question that I would ask your listeners is, what exactly did Last Stand mean in the context of Custer? In some ways, it was antithetical to a lot of things that Ted Turner represents in terms of trying to save the best wildness represented in Montana and the West, representing a way of living sustainably on the land, a way of recognizing the importance and the legacy of Native Americans and their attachment to bison. I think that there are a lot of things, and to be perfectly honest, I hope that Last Stand doesn't come across as being controversial, but I hope that it provokes a response among readers. I hope that they think about that. And I don't think that George Armstrong Custer should have a monopoly on Last Stand.
Welcome to The Right Question, a literary program that features writers from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Todd Wilkinson, who is the author of Last Stand, Ted Turner's Quest to Save a Troubled Planet. Let's just start with you. You started talking to Ted quite early in your career. I think your first interview with him was in 1992.
That's right.
And you've been a journalist for 25 years. So it was early in your career that you went to see him at the Flying D. He was new to the West. Just say a little bit about how you got there and what your first impression of Ted Turner was.
So I'm a young, late 20, early 30-something journalist, freelancer in the West. I'm covering the Northern Rockies for the Denver Post and freelancing. And Ted, of course, at that point was a larger-than-life figure, new to the state, had said things that were quite controversial, had riled the ranching community. He eliminated cattle on his property and brought back bison, caused a lot of derision among local cattle culture. And I landed this interview with him for a magazine that I was writing for. And his general manager said, "Don't be late. I'm driving out there in the middle of a snowstorm. A bison bull stands in the middle of the road. I'm getting late." And the manager had said, "If you are 1 minute late, Ted may cancel this interview." And so I arrive at the doorstep, and Jane Fonda is downstairs working out, and Ted is there. And I walk in, and I was frankly kind of intimidated. This was a big interview to get. And Ted had a reputation for not only intimidating journalists, but repelling their questions if he didn't like them. So at any point, I thought the interview could end.
And he told you when you came in the room that you had 20 minutes. And you ended up talking to him for a lot longer than that. So there must have been some kind of a rapport right from the very beginning.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I initially had an hour, or I was told that I had an hour with him. And so I had all of these notes in my reporter's notebook that I had, questions that I had prepared the night before. And I walked in and Ted said, 20 minutes. And so I had to scramble then to figure out what questions I could ask in the 20 minutes. And after he put me in my place, the conversation ended up going on for more than an hour. And it was actually at that interview in which Ted made his first allusion to what he wanted to accomplish on the Flying D, his largest ranch in Montana. And that was to capture the spirit of what existed in a Bierstadt, Thomas Moran, and George Catlin landscape paintings.
Well, let's talk about his land. He's one of the largest single landowners in the world. So describe what he's doing with all of that land.
Well, he realized very early on, he's this romantic, and he was infatuated by the film Gone with the Wind, where, you know, land is everything. And he realized that when one has larger land holdings, one has greater capacity and more options to do things. Very early on in his career, he had a few plantations in the Southeast, and he was always interested in having large mammal populations, carnivore populations on them. And what he realized was that in the West, he could offer homes to some of these wide-ranging species, and he could do it on his terms. He wouldn't have to answer to the government. These are public wildlife populations, but he wanted to offer them homes. And in addition to that, of course, it became the staging area for his bison herd that today numbers 55,000.
And when he first put those bison on there, as you say, he had some romantic ideas. He wanted to put the bison there and just have them be able to go wherever they wanted to. And he took down some fences that were there and then later had to put them back up.
Exactly. And so Ted has an aversion to fences. And so he basically deconstructed the old ranching infrastructure in the interior that had been used to manage cattle. And he had these ideas about bison that if they were just left to their own devices, they wouldn't, for example, eat in the riparian, the river corridor areas. He's an avid fly fisherman. But in fact, whether it's wildlife or whether it's domestic livestock, it all needs to be managed for the outcomes that you deem desirable. And so he realized that he needed to gently, with his bison herds, shepherd them across to different parts of the landscape. Otherwise, they too would congregate in some of the river corridors. In the past, he had, at least at the Flying D and some other properties, he had experienced overgrazing problems related to the historic cattle use and mud bogs and other things. And so, you know, in that sense, he had to realize that, you know, bison were not these perfect animals that he had initially envisioned. And I think that the record on the land for the last 20 years has shown that bison do carry a lot of advantages. For example, they're native species that evolved with the landscape. They evolved with climatic extremes that have occurred over millennia. They are more predator resistant. They don't need hay. You know, a lot of money gets poured into hay production for cattle.
Especially water usage, too.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so at his very basic level, he's a champion of bison. He loves the animals. They're one of his totem species, you might say. And so he's realized that using bison as an umbrella species, that there are, if you manage your land well for bison, you can do well by a lot of other native wildlife.
And he's got prairie dogs in this mix, which, you know, you go from the huge to the minuscule. Talk a little bit about the relationship between the prairie dogs and the bison.
Well, if one takes a natural history perspective, prairie dogs and bison are keystone species on the prairie. And what that means is, like beaver, they create habitats that affect and help enable a lot of other species. There are dozens of obligate species that have habitat created through prairie dogs, burrowing owls, black-footed ferrets, the most endangered land mammal in North America, rely solely on a diet of prairie dogs. And so Ted, on his Plains ranches, has nurtured both bison and prairie dog colonies, and the benefits for biological diversity have been enormous.
His neighbors haven't been too happy in some places. You're talking about ranches that are in, like, South Dakota and
Nebraska. You know, his ranchers, they treat them as vermin, and that's putting it mildly. They've told him to make sure that his prairie dog colonies don't spill onto their land, and You know, that's another thing about private land ownership. One can do what one wants on private land as long as it's not bothering or hurting the neighbors. And so Ted's done his best to be a good land steward in that regard.
In 1997, Ted Turner gave $1 billion to the United Nations. Why did he do that?
Well, it's a great question, and it's one that's still especially timely in this age. So Ted, being an internationalist with his CNN bureau strung around the world, knew the importance of the UN and its relevancy, having had many meetings with world leaders, having been involved with the Better World Society, which he originally founded. And so he knew how important it was in sort of setting a superstructure of unity around the world. The other thing that Ted knew, being a student of history, is that in the absence of the League of Nations and the violence that occurred during World War II, 70 million people died, 70 million of them innocent civilians. There was nothing really to stand up in the face of fascism, no unity. And then there were a couple of other reasons, too. One being that he didn't like what the conservatives were doing in Congress by withholding U.S. membership dues to the UN, almost $1 billion in arrears. And so he wanted to make good on that. He found it to be an embarrassment that the U.S., the largest donor, wasn't fulfilling its obligation. But he had one more thing, and that has strong resonance today. He wanted to use the night in which he announced the donation to lean on fellow plutocrats and billionaires and say, you know what? You need to stop hoarding your wealth. You need to give back to society, the society that has helped enable you to prosper.
And this leaning on the billionaires was way before Warren Buffett ever said anything.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ted is great friends with Warren Buffett and Bill and Melinda Gates. And in fact, he's part of the giving pledge in which a number of individuals have stepped forward and said that by the time they pass on, they want to give away half of their fortunes. There's an interesting story that Kofi Annan shared with me. Shortly after Ted made that announcement, Kofi Annan went to the Sultan of Brunei and said, you know, Ted Turner is pointing his fingers at guys like you. Are you going to step up? And the Sultan didn't. And Kofi Annan got a lot of mileage of Ted doing that because people just weren't stepping up and saying, you know what, we need to not be Gilded Age tycoons.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Todd Wilkinson, author of Last Stand, Ted Turner's Quest to Save a Troubled Planet. If you tuned in late, you can listen to what you missed online. Look for a link at therightquestion.blogspot.com. We'll be back shortly to talk about Turner's business model, his ideas about how the rest of us can help, and the dangers of complacency. Don't go away. you're talking about a lot of land, a lot of money. We're talking about a man with power. And many people have accused him because of this environmental bent that he has. They've accused him of being a left political leaner. But he says no. He says he's pro-business and he's a pro-capitalist. So just describe a little bit about what his business model is. You write several times about something called the triple bottom line.
Well, this is an important part about Ted Turner, the enigmatic figure. And I think he would defy anyone who tries to peg him into a certain hole. You know, at the very beginning of his career, he began as an acolyte of Ayn Rand and ultimately rejected that of a sort of me first, greed is good mentality. And what his attitude and what his management philosophy is knowing that no conservation is going to last unless it's economically sustainable. And if it involves money to support that conservation, it can endure unless it pays for itself. And so Ted is sitting on all of these land holdings, and he would like nothing better than the stewardship to carry on into the next generation involving his kids. And so he's tried to set up a model with the bison operation so that it pays for itself and to bring all of the assets forward pertaining to the triple bottom line. The triple bottom line is one that benefits local economies and larger economies, that benefits communities, and also derives benefits for the environment. And he doesn't see anything within that three-legged stool as being mutually exclusive.
And he's monitoring that triple bottom line on all of his properties all of the time.
Absolutely. As part of the research, I looked through his ledger books, and I mean, he monitors everything down to grass availability for bison and water and all of the inputs that go in. He also monitors his own carbon footprint, and what's interesting about that is healthy landscapes absorb more carbon.
He has been so involved in foreign affairs, I hardly know where to start. He's had discussions with people in Russia, with people in North Korea about environmental and nuclear issues. And there's one part in the book that I'd like you to read, just a short piece of. A story that Ted tells about the possibility of something that could happen set in New York City.
Sure. Turner asked the listener to imagine a balmy day in April, a nice one after a long winter. Central Park is a picture of tranquility. Workers take late lunches, cutting out early from cubicles. Times Square is its usual electric hive of humanity just before rush hour. Mobs of tourists pose in front of landmark marquees and billboards, taking snapshots for posterity. Street musicians and thespians perform next to food vendors. Some of those folks are hungry for a real meal and find their way over to my Ted's Montana Grill restaurant on West 51st Street for a bison burger or steak, Turner, ever the showman, says, grinning, then adding that his eatery is only a few blocks away from where his pal and fellow Montana ranch owner David Letterman broadcasts his late-night television show at the Ed Sullivan Theater. How glorious New York is, Turner says. It's the cultural capital of the world. For us, it's what Athens, Rome, and Constantinople represented in their primes. Among the frenetic bustle on this otherwise placid day, he describes a van creeping forward in bumper-to-bumper traffic. The vehicle's driver pulls in front of a modest high-rise near Broadway and 7th Avenue. Hazard lights on, the motorist appears to be making a routine delivery. Impatient cabbies are log-jammed behind the vehicle and honk their horns. Passers-by on foot, dammed up at a crosswalk, shout insults. A policeman walks to the window to tell the driver to shoo on because his rig is disrupting the orderly flow of things. The driver is a nobody, Turner notes, explaining that his protagonist has no wealth or influence, yet he's carrying the accumulated power of the ages. Economic desperation, hopelessness, perhaps misplaced religious zealotry, all of it combined with the hatred for American foreign policy and imperiousness, have brought him to this turning point. He doesn't believe he has anything to live for, and the rest of the world has indicated to him that it doesn't care, Turner says. The man's hand is twitching. He grins at the attending officer. From this nano instant forward, Turner says, everything that is great and secure about Manhattan, America, and the world will inexplicably change. All that our civil society represents, all of our progress and dreams and thoughts about the future based on our accomplishments of the past will disappear, he says, and we can't ever go back. There isn't a do-over. We ignored the wake-up calls, the hard work that our ancestors put in to build a better world for us is all for naught. What we gave our grandchildren was complacency.
That's a pretty harsh scene, and a lot of people would say, well, he's just grandstanding. He's just trying to scare people.
You know, I've spoken to a number of nuclear experts, people in government, including former Senator Sam Nunn of Georgia, who co-founded the Nuclear Threat Initiative with Ted, and Graham Allison, who's a former Assistant Secretary of Defense, now at Harvard. These are kinds of scenarios that these guys, who were military hawks at one point, take very seriously. And they're scenes that allies, people such as George Shultz and Henry Kissinger, who are all part of this this anti-nuclear thread, they worry about. They worry about the double threat that exists today, encapsulated in the nuclear threat.
Wasn't there a scene like this that was thwarted in New York?
Well, that's interesting. Only a few weeks after Ted and I had this conversation, there was a man that wanted to create a dirty explosive and drove a van actually to the same place in Times Square that Ted had presciently described, which was fairly remarkable. So, you know, as Turner says, if something like this happens, people will say, why weren't we more vigilant?
Well, Turner personally is, of course, making great efforts to try to make sure that his grandchildren don't accuse him of complacency. He, as you mentioned before, he's set up a trust for his land and for his money that will keep his environmental practices going into the future. And he's got five children
right,
who are running this foundation.
Right.
And so he's doing his part. What is he suggesting that other people with money should be doing?
Well, for Ted, the family foundation model works because it's a way to bring children into the decision-making process and to really look beyond generations. And so he became a firm believer early on when he first started to accumulate his mass fortune. He actually went to a seminar that had a discussion about how people could convey wealth rather than just handing their children large sums of money with no sort of prescription on what to do, but how the children could be brought into financial decision-making processes. But of course, few of us are plutocrats. And so, you know, Turner believes that anybody who owns a little bit of land somewhere, it becomes a family decision. And that, you know, that's one of the things, too, that he honors in America's agrarians, who are constantly thinking about the future. And just like Ted Turner, they need to be economically sustainable because you can't pass a lot of debt on to your children and expect them to carry on a legacy.
Right. Well, there's something that he wrote in the foreword to the book that intrigued me, because I was thinking, what can I do? What can the rest of us do? And he says, quote, "You don't need to have a fortune to make a difference in leaving the world a little better off. All that's required is a will and a belief that you can. What money can give you, if you're willing to part with it, is an ability to operate at scale." So he's just saying, if you're a billionaire, then do something with all of that money. And if you're not a billionaire, plant a garden in your yard or something, I guess, is how I interpret it.
Well, yeah, absolutely. He sees myriad possibilities for all of us. Getting involved in the political process is one of them. Being better stewards of our own little manicured lawns and pieces, we can make those things more wildlife friendly. We can think about the pesticides that we throw on them. He really is a firm believer in capital D democracy. But you know what else? He's also a firm believer in capital C capitalism. And again, you know, it's interesting. Some people on the left side of the political spectrum, they're accused by people on the right side of the spectrum of having no business sense. And I think Ted stands as a large contradiction to those claims.
I would say so. Well, there's one more piece of the book I'd like you to read, and it's also from the foreword that Ted wrote. So if you wouldn't mind sitting in for Ted too, we'll have you read it. And I realize there's a mention of your own name here, but you can do it.
If I could pull off Ted's affectation, I would. So I apologize. We live in an age when we desperately need miraculous breakthroughs. Allow me then to invoke a sports analogy that I hope you'll think about as you begin Todd Wilkinson's book, Last Stand. The world is in peril, and it's time for all of us to put our rally caps on. This isn't a liberal or conservative issue. Don't believe it when the folks on television try to portray it that way. To set the context, imagine that it's the bottom of the seventh inning, and the home team, that's the side playing for preservation of Mother Earth and civilization, is down by a couple of runs. The opposing team has an imposing lineup. The names on the backs of the jerseys are apathy, cynicism, greed, sloth, violence, cruelty, hatred, intolerance, and selfishness. All is not lost, yet. But in order to win, we as citizens watching from the bleachers need to rise to our feet. It's time that we band together, make some noise, suit up and become heroes, and remind others who are trying to mount a comeback that we're on the same side. We can't commit any more serious errors. Instead of doing dumb things, we need to play smarter, because this is the one game we can't afford to lose. If there's anything that Last Stand does, I hope that it will inspire you to consider that, by working together, as neighbors, as business people, as citizens and inhabitants of the only planet in the cosmos known to contain life, we have the capacity to change the trajectory of the world. Of course, we have no other choice.
Todd Wilkinson has been a professional journalist and author for more than 25 years. He lives in Bozeman, Montana. There's more information about him and Last Stand at therightquestion.blogspot.com, where you'll also find links to our Facebook page and podcast.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau, Lisa Simon, David Moore, and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to author information, audio, and our Facebook and podcast feeds at therightquestion.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.